Harry Crewe's life sounds like one of the wild novels he's known for. Raised on a dirt-poor tenant farm in South Georgia, he rose through the ranks of university elites and New York publishing houses to become an unlikely and singular voice in literature in the 1960s and 70s. His novels The Gospel Singer, Car, The Hawk is Dying, and many others have become cult classics, awash in whiskey and grit. A new biography of Harry Crewe is out now. Author Ted Geltner first met the aging writer while working as a journalist in Gainesville, Florida, and spent the next 12 years interviewing and getting to know Crewe firsthand. The result is the book Blood, Bone, and Marrow. Producer Mike Johns spoke with him about putting the larger-than-life story on the page.
You actually had the pleasure of meeting the man, so could you introduce us to the Harry Crewe that you met?
Well, I met him in 2004. They filmed the one time that one of his novels was brought to the screen was then. It was a book called The Hawk is Dying. I was a reporter at the Gainesville Sun at the time, and I got the assignment to write about it and to call Harry. And so that was the first time I spoke with him. And, you know, it was an interesting conversation. You know, he was told me what he was going to do with all the money that they were paying him for the movie in ways that could not be printed in the newspaper. And then he was, you know, mostly concerned with the hawks that they were using in the filming of the movie. You know, he wanted to make sure that they were feeding them live bait, you know, because that's what they need to thrive. But anyway, so I met him then, and then I, kind of got the Harry Crewe beat and interviewed him a lot of times as a newspaper writer after that.
So decades before you had opportunity to meet him, Harper Lee herself proclaimed that Faulkner had returned after reading his second novel. But you write in the book that Harry never wanted to be called a Southern writer. Can you talk about that inner conflict and sort of his place in Southern literature, literature in general?
Yeah, that's kind of how he was categorized, was as a Southern writer and, you know, in the line of Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor. And, you know, he was felt honored by that. But at the same time, he didn't see himself as a Southern writer. You know, he didn't think that those were the only themes that he dealt with. You know, what he wrote about was kind of more universal. But he has gone down kind of in that. That's how he's usually categorized. And he's also spoken of as the father of a genre called grit lit, which was Southern literature that focused more on the working class and the trailer parks and that sort of thing, that really was not the focus of a lot of previous Southern literatures.
Yeah, and his influence went far beyond the world of writers. I mean, there was a punk band named after him, a lot of musicians and artists sort of took his lead as well.
Yeah, that's true. Later in his life, he was kind of a cult figure, and a lot of musicians somehow connected with him.
Harry Crewe, for a writer of his ilk, I mean, he had such a rich self-made mythology, like you said, full of, you know, circus freaks, Georgia farmland, whiskey, women. The book spends a lot of time in university writing programs, in the classroom. Can you talk about Harry Crewe, the character, versus Harry, the professor and the professional novelist?
Well, yeah, Harry, he cultivated this image, you know, not that he, you know, planned it out and everything, but, you know, but just his the way that he acted and the way that he came across, you know, lent itself to the sort of wild man image that he had. And he used that, you know, to kind of make a name for himself, and especially in journalism, you know, when he was writing for Playboy and Esquire, you know, and to get kind of, you know, to make money and to get hired, you know, it was, you know, you hire Harry Crewe, the the crazy writer who you never know what he's going to do. And people would invite him in to speak, the same sort of thing. He used to say that, you know, he got off the plane for a speaking engagement and they were there with a bottle of whiskey for him. So you know, it worked for him, but he also fought against it to a degree, you know, because he thought that a lot of times people would only concentrate on that, on the image and the, you know, the anecdotes of his you know, drunken behavior, and they wouldn't concentrate as much on his writing, which, you know, what he devoted his life to. So, you know, it was kind of a double-edged sword for Harry. At University of Florida, at least, it had a great tradition. You know, Andrew Lytle, the Harry's mentor, you know, and also a guy who had earlier taught Flannery O'Connor, built the program at University of Florida. They hired Harry once he finally got published, and he really was the face of University of Florida creative writing for a long time. I guess what people would say is that he was, you know, people were attracted to the program to come, you know, because they would learn about Harry, and then they wanted to be Harry, you know, so that he was turning out a lot of wannabe, you know, Harry Cruises, but he was beloved as a teacher, and he was really an incredible motivator, you know, and you know, they said that to be in a Harry Cruise classroom was like to watch a performance, you know. So his students would say that, you know, at the end of class they couldn't wait to run back to their dorm and get to their typewriter, you know, he really had that ability, and I think that was the strongest thing about him, creative writing teaching.
Yeah, and beyond that, I mean, there's a pretty enormous body of work. I mean, he was very, very prolific. He wrote at least a novel a year. He was always working. He wrote very quickly. Can you talk, just spend a little while talking about his work and about the sort of the arc of his work over his lifetime, the things that he wrote about and where his writing went?
Well, you're right. When he spent a decade with no success at all. You know, he really, you know, said he was teaching himself how to be a writer. I mean, he was, you know, had gone through the University of Florida creative writing program, but then he for 10 years really barely published at all. I mean, he was writing and getting rejected, and he had an epiphany somewhere in that decade where he felt he somehow learned that what he needed to write about was you know, where he came from and his people in Bacon County, Georgia. Before that, he had been trying to be someone he wasn't. So once he came to that revelation, I think writing started to become easy for him, and that's why he was so prolific. He wrote his first book, The Gospel Singer, you know, in 6 months, you know, he had been rejected over and over, and that, you know, that book was you know, accepted immediately. You know, really, the critical reaction was tremendous, and then after that, you know, he took off, and just like you said, a book a year, which is crazy for a writer of literary fiction. So. And that was probably the most prolific period of his life. The one thing about him, no matter what was going on in his life, he was always writing. Even in these, you know, there's a period of 9 years where he didn't publish any novels. He was still writing 500 words a day, you know, when he could. So,
If I learned anything about Harry Cruise, that he had an amazing amount of discipline as a writer. Before that fallow period, though. In the early 70s, Cruise transitioned from novelist to journalist, though, you know, a journalist in the vein of folks like Hunter S. Thompson and Gay Talese. Can you talk about that work a little bit? You mentioned his work for Playboy and Esquire.
Right. In 1974, Playboy called him up. You know, there was just Harry Cruise fans on the editorial staff at Playboy, and they said, would you like to go to Alaska, to Valdez, Alaska, where they were just getting ready to build the Trans-Alaskan pipeline. And we're going to send you up there. We just want you to spend some time there, see what you find, and turn in 12,000 words. And
yeah, that's a pretty ridiculous assignment to, like, by today's standards. Yeah, just go check it out, and you know.
right. But it was a perfect assignment for Harry. You know, Harry had zero journalism experience at the time, and that's a lot about what that article turned out to be, was like Harry saying, I don't know how to interview anybody. I don't really know what to do, you know, and then just kind of going to bars and finding people and talking to them and writing down what they say. So it was that's what he did. And, you know, he ended up with a tattoo that he didn't remember getting. And, you know, all this stuff went into the article, you know, and but it's a great piece, and had a great reaction to it. And aside from that, from, you know, the reaction of the editors, millions more people knew about Harry Cruz because, you know, this is the early 70s. Playboy was you know, one of the biggest magazines in the country, and 5 million circulation. You know, Harry's books did not really sell well. So, I mean, he, prior to his journalism career, I mean, he was, you know, known about in literary circles, but he didn't have any sort of a national presence. But once he started writing for Playboy, and then shortly thereafter, Esquire hired him to write a monthly column called Grits. It really did a lot for his career because, you know, then he was well known. He started to write screenplays, and he just had entry into a lot of different markets that he hadn't had before.
With Harry's drinking, his womanizing, this proud sort of crudeness that he cultivated.
It's a good way to put it.
Yeah. He could charitably be called, by today's standards, problematic. Can you talk about what you think is important about telling his story now, shedding light on his life and his work, for this next generation of writers and readers, you know, with all of the blood and the booze attached to it?
Yeah, I think that he kind of, to a degree, faded from the American consciousness. You know, he all of his old books, those ones that he wrote, you know, in the 60s and 70s, they're all out of print. You can't really get them. His work has, even now, a lot of his novels are, you know, optioned for films, but they never seem to make it to the screen. I mean, there's even, you know, even now there's some that are, you know, in the hands of producers. But he's got a tremendous body of work that that really deserves attention, you know. So I do think that in writing his story and you know, bringing him to life a little bit and might lead to some reintroduction of some of his old novels, and so, you know, and maybe removed a little bit from the Harry Cruz legend, you know, and if some of the books can be brought back into print, and he might be, you know, his work might be kind of accepted into the literary canon to a greater degree.
Do you have a favorite Harry Cruz story?
Well, let me see. There are so
oh God,
many.
Yeah, there's so many.
This is just from, you know, as a professor, this one just popped into my mind, and I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but you were asking about, like, him in creative writing programs and things like that. And, you know, he didn't always really fit into, like, the academic world, and he always said that he was, you know, of the university but not part of the university, you know, like he was a writer who taught, you know. So there was this one little anecdote that just, I'm just remembering now, where he was in a staff meeting, and they were talking about, you know, a faculty meeting at the University of Florida, and they were talking about, you know, people getting tenure and, you know, that's the most important thing in academia and what was important, you know, and somehow they got around to, you know, whether it was important to write novels or whether it was important to write, you know, literary criticism and the type that English professors write. You can imagine that Harry, that would exercise Harry, and Harry, you know, stood up and started stomping around and saying, I challenge anyone here to weigh their books against my novels. You know, he wanted to see which was heavier, to see which should be given more weight. You know, so that one always makes me laugh. That's you know, that's pretty tame for Harry, but that's a funny little Harry story.
Yeah, and I think that works for public radio. Ted Geltner, associate professor of journalism at Valdosta State and author of Blood, Bone, and Marrow, a biography of Harry Cruz. Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Mike.